Who's read Bhagavad Gita? Okay, well, that looks better. Who's read all of Srimad Bhagavatam? So. These books, Srila Prabhupada writes about four books: Active Devotion, Bhagavad Gita, Srimad Bhagavatam, and Chaitanya Charitamrita, or Teachings of Lord Chaitanya, which is summary study of Chaitanya Charitamrita. So it says if you read these four books, then you can perfect your spiritual life. Or it's not necessary to read other books, or other spiritual books, what to speak of non-spiritual books. But you can. But even if you don't have time, often people are very busy making ends meet nowadays, and so they don't have so much time. So if that's all you do is study them, this is like sort of a study book. It's hard to just read this. You need to. And for that part, most of Srila Prabhupada's books, Chaitanya Charitamrita, in many parts, that's very much a readable book. It's something that you just read, Lord Chaitanya's pastimes, or the Krishna book about Krishna's pastimes. That's easy reading. And then Srimad Bhagavatam, in many places it can be quite taxing philosophy. That's worth studying. And Nectar of Devotion is really the science of devotional service. And Srila Prabhupada uses the word memorize, that it should be memorized. It's like the type of thing that you do. It's like mathematics. You don't sit down, maybe unless you're a mathematician, but for most people you don't sit and read a mathematics book. You learn it, and you learn the formulas and learn equations, but it's not a reading thing. Nectar of Devotion is, it should also be memorized, because it gives a proper understanding, a framework for what bhakti is about. And particularly the first part of bhakti, which is of relevance. All of everything's relevant, but could be said of more relevance, is the devotional service and practice, sadhana bhakti. There are these three parts of Nectar of Devotion: sadhana bhakti, bhava bhakti, prema bhakti, and then it goes on to rasa, different types of rasa and so on, a mixing of rasas. So one should know about sadhana bhakti, because it's the means. Sadhana is called the means. So if you want to get somewhere and you don't know how to drive, or worse still, if you don't know how to walk, then you don't have any means for getting where you're going. So sadhana is compulsory. One has to know, how does one chant Hare Krishna, what is the purpose, the benefit of hearing Srimad Bhagavatam, what are the different pitfalls of devotion. It's like anything. Everything has a means that you want to acquire something. You need to have a real grasp of that. And it requires more than just memorizing, in the sense of memorizing something that you don't know how to put it into practice, because this you really need to put into practice. So sadhana bhakti needs to be put into practice. And it's a great science. The subsequent parts, bhava bhakti, prema bhakti, they're there in order to tell us what the goal is. So you want to go somewhere, but if you have no real clear idea of where you want to go, even if you have the means to get there, that again becomes a problem. I want to go to such and such place. What's there? I don't know. What's it like? I don't know. What's the weather? I don't know. why do you want to go there? I don't know. And that's the problem. If you don't know about the goal, then you won't want to go there. So there's such a thing as ritualistic activity, which is when people practice, perform activities, and they don't know why, and they don't know where they're going, and they don't really care. It's just part of life. That's called religiosity. Religiosity is just when people have a certain sense or degree of piety and they practice spiritual life because they're not as degraded as gross materialists. It's so they find it integral to their being, but they don't practice spiritual life with the idea of getting out of the world. They practice spiritual life with the idea of being in the world. In other words, they have no goal. Their goal is here. And it's a fact. Material world is quite attractive. It's attractive for those who are in it. For those who aren't in it, it holds no attraction. But for those who are in it, it's attractive. And therefore, there has to be something, as Krishna says, param dushtari vartate. There has to be something more attractive in order to want to practice. So why do I want to do sadhana if I don't know what is the sadhya? Sadhya means the goal, perfection. So if you don't know what perfection is, why will you practice? And that's why Rupa Goswami gives both are here, both the process of sadhana as well as the goal, sadhya. They're all very nicely delineated. And if you know about the latter, then you go through the hardships of the former, because it's not easy. It's easy, but for people in Kali Yuga, nothing's easy. Even easy thing is difficult. So even the minimum is my maximum. So what we do, chant Hare Krishna, and take prasadam, and dance, and so that's the minimum. There's nothing easier than this. But even this minimum is really sort of a total strain for most of us. And in the rasa portion of Nectar of Devotion, then there's a description. Rasa means taste. So this whole book is called Bhakti Rasa Amrita Sindhu. Bhakti means devotion. Rasa is one of those Sanskrit words for which there's no real English corresponding word. But we use the word mellow or the taste. Actually, the relationship is another eternal relationship. So Bhakti, Rasa, Amrita, Sindhu. The ocean of the nectarian mellows of pure devotion. This is called Bhakti Rasamrita Sindhu. And in these rasas or relationships, there are five different types of relationships that you can have with God. Generally, people view God as being almighty and themselves as being God's servants. So they have either one of two conceptions of God. That is one which is completely neutral, in which they're in awe of God, but they don't do anything. And the other one is when they're in awe of God, but they serve Him. So one is called neutrality, and the other one is called servitude. This is generally what you'll find in most non-Vedic religions and even in Vedic religions. And then beyond that, when God's personality is actually known, then there are another three further mellows, and that is mellow of friendship and parental relationship and a conjugal relationship. So all of these five exist, and these are considered to be primary. So ultimately, we are trying to be established in one of these five relationships with Krishna, most likely the last four, but probably the last three, somewhere in there. This is Lord Chaitanya's gift. And then there are also secondary mellows. In other words, there are other moods that supplement these five. These five are what's called Stai Bhava. Stai Bhava means that this is the bhava, this is the mood that's stai, this is what you're situated in. It doesn't change. And then these others, like dread and ghastliness, which we'll read about, these are some things that sometimes come and sometimes go. They're spiritual, but they're built upon the existing, one of the five existing relationships. And they're of a, they're either of a temporary nature or they're of a supplemental nature. Like, for instance, chivalry is another, the seven of these. So Arjuna, he's Krishna's Sakha, he's Krishna's friend. That's his Stai Bhava, that's his eternal relationship with Krishna. But he's also a Kshatriya. So Kshatriyas have a chivalrous mood. Parichakatmakam karma. Anyway, so Krishna says chivalry. This is one of the heroism, is one of the characteristics of a Kshatriya. So Arjuna also has the chivalrous mood. His mood with Krishna is mainly a friendship, but chivalry is there because he's a fighter, he's a king. And so in that relationship in Dwarka, therefore he, Yudhisthira Maharaj, and others also have this as a supplemental mood. Now, here we're reading about dread and ghastliness. In ecstatic love for Krishna in dread, there are two causes of fear. In other words, here, dread and fear, same thing. Either Krishna himself or some dreadful situation for Krishna. What causes something? And that's the first thing that you always analyze. Why? Why is there something? What's the cause? Hetu. When Krishna says, Hetu Nani, what is the cause? So, technically, earlier on, it was already described. This cause is called Udipan. Udipan means that which gives rise to something. Udip, some, like you light a lamp. So something that sparks something off. It sparks off a feeling. So he says two things cause this dread. Is dread of Krishna or some dreadful situation for Krishna. When a devotee feels himself to be an offender at Krishna's lotus feet, Krishna himself becomes the object of dreadful ecstatic love. And when out of ecstatic love, friends and well-wishers of Krishna apprehend some danger for him, that situation becomes the object of their dread. Okay, here's the example. When Rikshiraj was in front of Krishna fighting and suddenly realized that Krishna, Rikshiraj is Jambavan, and suddenly realized that Krishna is the Supreme Personality of Godhead, Krishna addressed him thus, "My dear Rikshiraj, why is your face so dry? Please do not feel threatened by me. There's no need for your heart to tremble like this. Please calm yourself down. I have no anger towards you. You may, however, become as angry as you like with me to expand your service in fighting with me and to increase my sporting attitude." In this dreadful situation of ecstatic love for Krishna, Krishna himself is the object of dread. In Bhagavad Gita, in the 11th chapter, when Krishna reveals the universal form, Arjuna also displays this dread. He starts to think, who in the past, I just dealt with Krishna like he's my friend. Sometimes I used to joke with him, sometimes I actually make fun of him. But now I realize that actually he's the Supreme Personality of Godhead. So this past activity caused in Arjuna dread. And the cause is always love. It's not for any other particular reason. So that's an example. Here also, you know, if you remember this story, Jambavan, where Krishna came to Jambavan's cave and he wanted to get back his Shyamataka jewel. So they fought. And after they fought for, I don't know, 30 days, 40 days, something like that, So then Jambavan figured out, he says, no one can fight like the only person, because he was an associate of Lord Ramachandra, so he thought the only person who can fight like this is Ramachandra. Therefore, this Krishna must be Lord Ramachandra. And then he became, then it wasn't like he was just fighting some enemy. He realized he was fighting the person that he loved, so he became aware by fear, oh, I've committed an offense. I'm committing an offense to Krishna. There is another instance of a dreadful situation with Krishna as the object, as follows. After being sufficiently chastised by child Krishna in the Jamuna River, the Kaliya snake began to address the Lord. O killer of the Mura demon, I have acquired many mystic powers by my austerity and penances, but before you I am nothing. I am most insignificant. Therefore, please be kind upon a poor soul like me and don't be angry with me. I did not know your actual position, and out of ignorance I have committed such horrible offenses. Please save me. I am the most unfortunate, foolish creature. Please be merciful to me. This is another instance of the ecstasy of dread in devotional service. So similar example of Kaliya, who, I don't know where this is stated. There's a very interesting thing here. He says, Kaliya says, I've acquired many mystic powers by my austerity. It's not in Krishna book. It's maybe missed from some other source. Because many of these pastimes are recorded in many different Puranas, and there's different angles or information that's given on them. But anyway, Kaliya also came to the conclusion that this is Krishna. But of course, there's a difference between Kaliya and Jambavan. Is that Jambavan or Arjun, they were already in a relationship of love. They just didn't realize that Krishna's supremacy. Kaliya was inimical towards him. So how can his be actually claimed to be rasa? And the answer is because first Kaliya became purified at heart. So by Krishna dancing on his head, Kaliya became purified. When he became purified, he then developed love for Krishna, and then he started to regret that which he was doing, and he then felt this type of rasa. When the Kesha demon was causing disturbances in Vrindavan by assuming a large horse's body that was so big he could jump over the trees, that's a big horse, Mother Yashoda told her husband, Nanda Maharaj, our child is very restless, so we'd better keep him locked up within the house. I have been very worried about the recent disturbances of the Kesha demon, who has been assuming the form of a giant horse. When it was learned, because this isn't in Krishna book either, he just sort of like appears on the scene, gets killed, and that's it. But here they're already talking about him earlier. When it was learned that the demon was entering Gokula in an angry mood, Mother Yashoda became so anxious to protect her child that her face dried up and there were tears in her eyes. These are some signs of ecstasy, of dread in devotional service, caused by seeing and hearing something that is dangerous to Krishna. So in the first one, Krishna was the object. And now here he's the subject. Someone's not feeling dread because of what they did to Krishna, but they're afraid of what it is that's going to be happening to Krishna. Here in Mother Yashoda, she's thinking that this demon is going to be a source of danger for Krishna. So he wants to, by all means, protect them. And she becomes overwhelmed, so overwhelmed that these symptoms appear. And of course, this is there with all of these demon situations. And the question can be, well, what is the need for all of these other rasas or relationships? And the answer is it enriches Krishna's pastimes. It revitalizes these secondary rasas. They vitalize and keep fresh the actual original Sai Baba. So, like in this example, so Mother Yashoda is the original mother. She's the perfect mother. And she has unlimited motherly love for Krishna. But what is it that will increase that love? How do you increase something that's unlimited? And how do you intensify it? You put the object of love in danger. So if a mother thinks that her child's in danger, what does that mean? She gives up on him? No, it just increases her love even more. So, is that true? Mothers. Isn't it? Then it becomes much more intense. So, and that's going on a daily basis in Vrindavan. And even in the spiritual world, it may be going on, or at least they think it's going on. So they're constantly in a state of stress. So, but you have to get ready for that, because that's what goes on in the spiritual world. People are in anxiety. Anxiety in the material world is not good for you. Anxiety in the spiritual world is good for you. It increases the loving propensity, loving attachment towards Krishna. And this is always going on. Here's another example. After the Putana witch had been killed, some friends of Mother Yashoda inquired from her about the incident. Mother Yashoda at once requested her friends, "Please stop, please stop. Don't bring up the incident of Putana. I become distressed just by remembering this incident. The Putana witch came to devour my son, and she deceived me into letting her take the child on her lap. After that, she died and made a tumultuous sound with her gigantic body." So here's another. Here's not exactly that the demon's there or the demon's coming, but just this thing that you just imagine that here's a little baby, and some demon comes to eat your child in disguise, and you invite him in, and you put your baby in their lap. So that's like something that sort of eats in a mother's mind for a long time. Here, the problem is it just keeps eating on her mind forever. So anytime someone brings it up, it just like places her into more dread, and that just increases the love. It keeps things going. It's like water. Water that doesn't move becomes stale, so it has to keep moving. So all of these different types of other ecstasies, they keep the Sthayi Bhava, the original loving relationship with Krishna, they keep it constantly moving. They stir it up all the time, and that way it's always fresh. And that gives increased taste to, in this case, Mother Yashoda, or the devotee, and it also gives increased relish with Krishna. Here's the last on dread. In the ecstasy of devotional service in dread, the unconstitutional symptoms are unconstitutional symptoms. Sometimes Prabhupada uses these words because there are, again, very difficult to find really suitable words for certain Sanskrit terms. Drying up of the mouth, exuberance, glancing behind oneself, concealing oneself. These are the unconstitutional means that they don't last for long. They're there for a little while and then they go. Searching after the endangered, lovable object and crying very loudly. Some other unconstitutional symptoms are illusion, forgetfulness, and expectation of danger. In all such circumstances, the ecstatic dread is the steady or constant factor. In other words, there's always this dread is there, but sometimes one will cry, sometimes one will be bewildered, sometimes the mouth will dry up, and then sometimes it will be wet, sometimes one will glance behind oneself or conceal oneself. These are just different symptoms. The dread is going on, but these characteristic symptoms come and go. Such dread is caused either by offenses committed or by dreadful circumstances. In other words, offenses committed to Krishna or dreadful circumstances threatening Krishna. Offenses may be committed in various ways, and the dread is felt by the person who has committed the offense. When dread is caused by a fearful object, this fearful object is generally a person who is fearsome in his features, nature, and influence. An example of an object which caused ecstatic dread is the Putana witch. Dread may be caused by the mischievous demoniac character, such as King Kamsa, and it may be caused by great powerful demigods such as Indra and Shankar. Demons like Tamsa feared Krishna, but their feelings cannot be described as ecstatic dread in devotional service. So this is just a last sentence, bears some explanation. And someone may say, well, I'm fearing, so is that rasa? And the answer is no, because it has to be bhakti rasa. It can't be something else. And what is bhakti? So anyabilasita sunyam jnana karma dinavritam anukulina krishna anushilanam bhakti uttama. These different symptoms, which are the first thing that's described in this book, the characteristics of pure devotional service, they have to be favorable towards Krishna. The mood here of Tamsa towards Krishna is not favorable. He's afraid of Krishna. He's dreaming about Krishna, that Krishna is going to kill him. But he wants to kill Krishna first. So he's not favorably disposed towards him. So just because you're afraid of Krishna, just because you have some type of interaction with Krishna, doesn't necessarily establish that as rasa. Rasa has to fulfill these qualifications. Anya abhilasita sunyam, that is that one has to be free from all abhilas, all desires. So you have to be pure at heart. Jnana karmadi anavritam, so no desire for liberation or enjoying the fruits of one's activities or mystic perfection. Anukulyena, and whatever you're performing, Krishna anushilanam, is favorable towards Krishna. Arjuna's attitude isn't favorable towards Krishna. So therefore, bhakti uttama. Therefore, it can't be termed uttam bhakti. We use the word pure devotional service, uttam bhakti, para bhakti. It means the same thing. Ultimately, that bhakti, which is capable of generating love for Krishna. And then the ghastliness continues. Well, let's just do that. It is understood from authoritative sources that an attachment for Krishna because of feelings of disgust sometimes presents a ghastly ecstasy in devotional service. The person experiencing such ecstatic love for Krishna is almost always in the neutral stage of devotional service, or shantaras. A description of ecstatic love caused by ghastliness is found in the following statement, quote, "This person was formerly interested solely in the matters of lust and sense gratification, and he had perfected the greatest skill in exploiting women to fulfill his lusty desires. But now how wonderful it is that the same man is chanting the names of Krishna with tears in his eyes, and as soon as he sees the face of a woman, he immediately becomes disgusted. From the indication of his face, I would think that he now hates sex life." In this mellow of devotional service and ghastliness, the sub-ecstatic symptoms are, we just come to that. So, feelings of disgust. It's very sort of difficult to conceive of this idea of disgust as being a type of ecstasy, or ecstasy manifesting as disgust. And the reason for that is due to our conditioning. So we confuse happiness with ecstasy, or confuse it or not confuse it, that's the only thing we can relate to it as. So we have experiences of material happiness, and then we think that also when ecstasy is being spoken about, it's the same thing. But it's a completely different substance. So, sat-chit ananda. This ananda is a divine thing. And it's the basis upon which emotions are built on the spiritual platform. It doesn't exist in the material platform. Sometimes the devotees say, well, I feel really ecstatic. So it's a nice use of the word, but that's not what you were feeling. You were feeling happy, but you weren't feeling ecstatic. Because when you feel ecstatic, then your mind doesn't go back anymore to any kind of material things. It's all gone. So real ecstasy, that happens when one is completely liberated from material entanglement, free from any connection with material energy. And the enjoyment, the reflection of that, that one experiences in the conditioned state, that's called happiness. So the abhas of ananda is happiness. Until that realization of what spirit or spiritual life is, then it becomes very difficult to understand how such apparently, because for us we think, well, happiness or joy is a positive feeling, whereas fear or distress is a negative feeling. Because we live in a world of duality. And that's what it means for us. It means that actually there is no such thing as happiness. There's just relative degrees of misery, and therefore the misery that we adjust ourselves to, that we can call happiness, and the stuff that's too much, that we call distress. So just like earlier on, it was getting warm in the room. So that was a source of distress. And then if it gets too cold, then that becomes a source of distress. On the other hand, you know, the cold, this type of weather is, for an Eskimo, is, it's warm, it's like a holiday. It's, we're off to the Bahamas. Whereas for us, it's just the opposite. Send him to India and he'll die before he gets off the plane, just of the heat. He won't be able to tolerate it. So for him it's suffering. So what is it? Is it happiness or is it distress? Obviously, neither happiness and distress are in either heat or cold. It's just the perception or the conditioning that we have when we say something's happy, something's distress, something's bad. But it's actually dvaita, dvaita, badragan, saying manodharma. This is all manodharma, it's all speculation. Now in the spiritual world, things are a little different. There's no duality, there's only one thing. Satchitananda, there's only these things. There's only spirit. Here, there's spirit and matter. There, there's only spirit. So everything's made of spirit. So the floor is spirit. Here, the floor is in spirit. Here, the floor is matter. Here, this body is matter. There, the floor is spirit. There, the house is spirit. Everything is spiritual. The trees are spiritual. Of course, here, the trees are also spiritual. But everything is about the trees is spiritual. Not only just the soul of the tree, but every part of the tree. So there's nothing else other than spirit in the spiritual world. So there's nothing else for distress to be made up of in the spiritual world other than ananda. There's no distress. It's all happiness. Here, it's just the opposite. So, what we perceive, or what we think, oh, here's ghastliness and dragnness, or someone's just actually feels disgust. How's disgust? It's something that vitalizes, that gives a certain emotion that in some way or another nurtures further the Sthayi Bhava, or the eternal relationship with Krishna. And it's made of the same stuff. It's made of the same substance, like atoms. Air is atoms. This floor is atoms. This body is atoms, whether it's hard or soft or liquid or anything, or furry or smooth, it's all made of atoms. It's the same thing. In spiritual world, everything's made of ananda. Sometimes it's hard, sometimes it's soft, sometimes it's disgust, sometimes it's like, but it's all the same thing. It's all bliss. So that's what it means. So sometimes we hear that, well, they're in anxiety, but at the same time, you know, just be happy forever. So which is it? Am I going to be happy forever? It's both. You're being happy forever, but in being happy forever, their happiness is, bliss is, that you experience all of this type of variety, but it's all made of happiness. Even the distress is made of happiness. Here the happiness is made of distress, and there the distress is made of happiness. So everything is made of happiness. The disgust is made of happiness, the dread is made of happiness, the ghastliness is made of happiness. And this mellow devotional service and ghastliness, the sub-ecstatic symptoms, those which come and go, are spitting upon the consideration of one's past life. Don't do it in here. You have to do that outside. Contorting the face, covering the nose, and washing the hands. There's also trembling of the body, forcible twisting of the body, and perspiration. Other systems which symptoms which may be present are shame, exhaustion, madness, illusion, frustration, humility, self-pity, restlessness, eagerness, and stunning of the body. These are not reversible equations. You know, like in chemistry, certain equations are reversible, or certain chemical reactions are reversible, and some only go one way. In other words, because the sub-ecstatic symptoms of devotional service and ghastliness is frustration, that doesn't mean every time you're frustrated, you're feeling ecstasy and ghastliness. So, in other words, ecstasy and ghastliness has that as a symptom, but that doesn't mean that every time you're feeling one of these symptoms, it's that. When love for Krishna is present within the heart, then yes. When not, then no. Then the cause generally will be something else, or a combination, but it won't be the real thing. When a devotee lamenting for his past abominable activities shows special symptoms on his body, his feeling is called ecstasy and devotional service and ghastliness. This is caused by the awakening of his Krishna consciousness. This means a devotee who's past the threshold of perfection. In this connection, there is the following statement. How can a person take pleasure in the enjoyment of sex life in this body, which is a bag of skin and bones, filled with blood and covered by skin and flesh, and which produces mucus and evil smells? End of quote. This perception is possible only for one who is awakened to Krishna consciousness, one who has become fully cognizant of the abominable nature of this material body. So just when you read things like this, don't skim over words like fully cognizant. I think like that. Okay, all right, you may think like that, but it's not some. That's not the only criteria. The other one is you're fully cognizant of the abominable nature of this material body. A fortunate child in the womb of his mother prayed to Krishna as follows. O enemy of Kamsa, I'm suffering so much because of this material body. Now I'm trapped within a mess of blood, urine, and liquid stool within the womb of my mother. Because I'm living in such a condition, I'm suffering great pangs. Therefore, divine ocean of mercy, please be kind to me. I have no ability to engage in your loving devotional service, but please save me. There's a similar statement by a person fallen in a hellish condition of life. He addresses the Supreme Lord thus, my dear Lord, Yamaraj has placed me in a situation which is full of filthy and obnoxious smells. There are so many insects and worms surrounded by the stools left by different kinds of diseased persons. And after seeing this horrible scene, my eyes have become sore and I am becoming nearly blind. I therefore pray, O my Lord, O deliverer from the hellish conditions of life. I have fallen into this hell, but I shall try to remember your holy name always, and in this way I shall try to keep my soul and body together. This is another instance of ecstatic love for Krishna in an abominable condition. Somehow or another, this advanced devotee had fallen into hell. It is to be understood that any person who is constantly engaged in chanting the holy names of the Lord, Hare Krishna, Hare Krishna, Krishna Krishna, Hare Hare, Hare Rama, Hare Rama, has attained a transcendental affection for Krishna, and as such, in any condition of life, he remains satisfied simply by remembering the Lord's name in full affection and ecstatic love. In conclusion, it may be stated that ecstatic love for Krishna and ghastliness appears during the development of dormant neutrality into developed affection. Here Prabhupada makes reference to this transitional stage between what the shantaras, what the sages experience. They experience great awe for Krishna, but there's no development of affection. And because affection isn't there, therefore they don't serve Krishna. That's the problem. If you love somebody, the natural propensity is to serve them. So how is it possible that these sages, they'll be absorbed in meditating and chanting Om, and they've achieved a certain perfectional stage, but it's unripe. It's unripe because whereas they become free from all material attachment, and they've developed, they have full faith in Krishna's omnipotency, still affection hasn't really manifested. And therefore, therefore they can just sit there and do nothing, because effectively that's what they're doing, is doing nothing. So, but there's more of that later on in the book. I'm sure you'll come to it later. Hare Krishna.